I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Patrick Lane joins me again. The distinguished poet and writer has just published a new collection of poems, Washita. We'll talk about it and more. He was recently invested in Officer of the Order of Canada, among many other awards he's received over a 50-year-plus career. He first appeared on the program in 2008 when his novel Red Dog, Red Dog was published. The website for more is at patricklane.ca. The book is from Harbor Publishing. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program in Saanich, British Columbia today, Patrick Lane. Mr. Lane, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Hey, by the way, it's Washita.
Washita.
Rather than Washita.
So.
I thought it was Washita, and then I was talking to a southern lady I know who's from the south, mm-hmm. and he says, no, sir, she said, that's Washita. So there you go.
There, yeah, okay. So, what does it mean for people? Because people will doubtless have not read the book yet. So, when they see that, they're probably going to wonder what that word is.
Yeah. Well, it's actually it covers the Washita Indians of Arkansas and a mountain range in Arkansas, which is called the Washita Mountains, and. In those mountains, there's a particular kind of stone that used to be quarried, and it's been always traditionally been used as a sharpening stone. It's one of the finest stones you can get for pulling a really pure edge on the edge of a blade. Sort of almost like subatomic particles of quartz, and it's just smooth like silk, and you can draw your knife across it. And my dad had one of those stones when I was a kid, that he used, and when I was a kid, I was told never to touch it. You know, yeah. I was never to put a blade to it because he didn't want me to scar the stone.
Yeah.
And it became a kind of symbol for me when I was a kid of, the kind of awe you have as a child of the kind of magical things that your father has around him, you know, and that for me was a magical thing. He kept it in a wooden box.
Mm-hmm.
Inside of a piece of deer hide, and he kept it oiled, so it was a very special little thing. I remember peek at it when I was a little kid, but I didn't dare take it out.
Mm.
So it became all of those things for me, and in one of the poems, the stone is mentioned, so I was searching for a title for the book, and Washita was just leapt out at me, and I thought, that's such a beautiful word, I think I'll put that as the title, so... And it's mysterious, too.
Yeah. There's hardly a poem in this book, Patrick, that doesn't reference an animal or mentions one. And this has always struck me about your work and some of the public speaking that you've done in recent years, the reverence that you have for the natural world. I think I wrote you once after one of your convocation speeches was excerpted in the Globe and Mail. That was just gorgeous. This reverence that you have for the natural world around you, that's something that you've always had, right?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was a young man, my reverence for the natural world was very destructive. I grew up in a, you know, I look back now, it's 75 years ago when I was a little, when I was born. I was born in 1939, so I go back a ways now, and the world I grew up in the 1940s and the 1950s, which is, like I say, 60, 65, 70 years ago, was a pretty violent world, and in many ways quite primitive in its approach to the natural world. Now, to my father, the natural world was an inexhaustible source of things that he could use in terms of being able to eat or burn or play with or just kill for the pleasure of killing. I grew up with a similar, with that kind of training,
mm-hmm.
but not that I was trained well by my father or by the men of his age. They were all soldiers who'd come back from the war, and they were pretty well strangers to us boys who'd been born before the war, and so his training was pretty perfunctory at best. And I mostly took, my understanding of how men were was that they destroyed things, so I did a lot of destruction when I was a young man. I remember once having a job driving a big cat tractor, a TD-24. I was building bush road in the mountains, and I was 16. I mean, why anybody would put a 16-year-old in a big machine now? They wouldn't do it now, but back then they did. And I got bored one day, and I just pushed trees over just for fun, just to watch them fall. So I destroyed part of a forest just for the fun of watching them fall, and I don't feel guilty about that now. I don't punish myself for that. I look at that and I say, why wasn't somebody, you know, teaching that boy about the reverence for living things? And this weekend, Lorne and I mean, I've been going over to the park across the street. The trees in there are covered with ivy. The ivy's growing in there, and it's throttling the trees. And I go over there. I've been going over there for quite a while, just cutting the ivy off the trees and protecting them, you know, because the ivy actually will strangle the trees. And so Lorna and I were over there cutting ivy, and there's something absolutely beautiful about, you know, stripping a tree of all this clutter of ivy that's climbing up it, you know. And I was leaning back against this, you know, 250, 300-year-old fir tree, just leaning back against the bark, you know. I cleared all the ivy off, and I knew it was going to, you know, and the tree would be able to breathe a little bit, you know. It was such a moment of such remarkable peace and amazing sort of contentment in me, you know. I could just sort of feel, I literally could feel the tree thanking me, yeah. Saying, thank God you did that. Jesus, I'm tired of that ivy. You know, and the kind of pleasure you get from that kind of reverence, that acknowledgement, you know, those things out there are alive.
Yeah,
they're like us, you know. We're all alive together, and sure, I eat things and I consume things, and things will consume me. But I've got to do it with some kind of to be reverential to some degree. That our native peoples, our Aboriginal peoples, have much to teach us about that, because we lost that a long, long time ago, way back, you know, when we became farmers and stopped living in the wild world. So. Anyway, that's a long answer to a short question.
But so what happens in the course of one's life that you get to that point that you need to be reverential? I mean, there's a difference between 75-year-old Patrick clearing ivy off a tree and 16-year-old Patrick knocking him down. At what point did you make that transition from one to the other?
That transition began to happen to me when I was in my 20s. My 20s happened in the late 50s, early 60s,
mm-hmm.
And I began to understand that world. I worked in the mills, the sawmills, and in the logging industry back when I was a young man, and I watched what those people did, and I remember being outraged by the way the forest was treated back then. It's still treated terribly. I mean, it's still monstrous what we do to them, but back then it was even worse. I remember this one big cut block. You know, they used the big cut blocks in the bush. You know, you can fly over BC and you can see the big cut blocks. You know, it's just mm-hmm. the big white squares in the wintertime. You always think it's moose pasture, but it's actually where they've scraped the forest off and left nothing behind. And I remember they had this cut block, and it was, and the forestry wanted them to take it out. It was full of cedar trees, but there was no market for cedar back then. And there was some good fir and spruce in there, and so they went in with cats, and they knocked all the cedar down and crushed it, and they called it blowdown.
Mm.
And the forestry guys that were there, the government workers, were paid off, and they just turned a blind eye to it. They got a little check in the mail, you know, for not watching what was going on. And I watched that kind of stuff go on, the corruption in the industry, and I was, you know, it changed me, you know, working in the bush and working in the country. I saw rough stuff back then, and I swore that I would do what I could to change that. As far as animals and things, well, you know, it's hard when you live in the middle of a city. I remember Joe Rosenblatt, an old buddy of mine, you know, great poet, wonderful painter now, you know. And Joe, I used to wonder at him, you know. He would always, in his paintings and drawings and in his poems, they were always peopled with insects. You know, bumblebees and stuff like that. And I used to wonder about that. And then I realized that that was the only wild animals he had in the downtown core of Toronto, were rats and squirrels, bumblebees and spiders and flies.
Hmm.
That was the wild world to little Joe Rosenblatt. And he put them in his poems because that's all he had, because everything else was gone. So it's very hard to understand the destruction of a forest when you live inside a city and you never go out there and take a look at it. So.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just, for me, the images in the poems reflect, I think, my mindset today. You know, I mean, I, like everyone, I think there's a lot of grief out there, grieving.
Mm-hmm.
We watch a world disappearing in front of our eyes, and none of us know what to do. But maybe if you just went out in the bush and cut a few, some ivy off some trees, you might feel better.
So
that's
is
sort of the way I
take
some action.
Yeah, is the mindset that you're in, is it sentimentality?
No, sentimentality is a failure of feeling. That's getting silly about things, you know. True sentiment is a really deep feeling, big heart, deep down in the heart. You know, I mean, there's an anonymous presence that surrounds us, you know. Some people call it God, you know, and some people call it the spirits, and you can call it what you like, you know, but to deny that that's there is crazy. You know, me and leaning back against a big fir tree, talking to a fir tree in the morning, you know, I'm not talking to some kind of big dead stick sticking up there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking to something that's alive just like I am. So, you know, it's not sentimentality.
Is there a... When you're writing the poems that are in this book, though, I mean, there's one poem in here which I guess you were typing with one finger, so you were injured at the time.
Yeah, I wrecked my shoulder. I'm a one-finger typist, which people find very amusing.
Uh-huh.
But you know, I still learned how to type in a logging camp, you know, so I had a little portable typewriter, and it was the one class I could have taken in high school that I didn't, so I never remembered much from high school. And it was, if I'd remembered anything, I wish I'd learned how to type, but I didn't. So anyway, I stressed my shoulder so badly I couldn't lift my arm and I couldn't type. So and I was in the middle of a novel, and I just couldn't type with my right hand, and so I decided to turn and write some poetry. I hadn't written any poems for quite a long time. At least a year or so while I was working on the novel. And so I wrote with my left hand. And my one finger typing with my left hand didn't know where the letters were. My right hand knew where they were, but my left hand didn't. So I had to look for them. So I would go, you know, I want to write the word thus. So I'd go, let's see, there's a T.
Yeah.
And then I'd go H. And then I'd go E. And now I had the word thus written. And we came that slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the poems settled to a kind of immense slowness as they unfolded in front of me. I mean, most people, I watch other writers write, and they're tap, 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 you know, and I'm normally, you know, I go about 20 words a minute, but when I was doing this one, I was going, I don't know, 3 words a minute.
Yeah.
So things slowed down, and the poems in the book, if anything, I think, for me, they're very... very reflective and thoughtful, because I had to think slowly in order to get them down. I couldn't rush ahead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the word "the" down, and then you're faced with the dilemma. I'm writing the "the." My mind is trying to race ahead with which adjective is going to go. What noun am I talking about? When you put down the word "the," you're going to put down some object after that. You know, the tree, the heron, the bumblebee, the bat. Something, you're going to put something in there, and by the time I got the THE down, I'd discarded 55 nouns and was thinking about adjectives, so it was an interesting process for a writer. But I've always been a slow typist and a slow writer, and the poems were end-stop lines. They stopped usually with a period or at least another piece of punctuation, because I was just exhausted by the time I got 9 words down.
In reading the book, I do get the sense that you are reflective, that you're feeling thoughtful. And is this where you are as a writer at this point?
Well, I think this is where I am as a man. You know, I'm 75 now, and, you know, it's I got a fewer years ahead of me than I have behind me. So, you know, you look at your life, and you try to express what you feel. Well, I mean, I can wander off and do all kinds of abstractions and say, you know, well, I mean, I'm an older man now and I've got deep feelings about love and death and all those things, but that doesn't really change anything or do anything. What you try to do is to catch. You want a reader to when they hear a poem or when they read a poem, to be changed a tiny bit. If you can change somebody just a moment, even if they're only changed for a moment,
mm-hmm.
like a couple of seconds, if they suddenly go, oh, then that's the most a piece of writing can do, I think. sometimes it's a bigger role, but they don't. That doesn't always happen, you know.
Yeah.
There's a poem in here that. Yeah, you can edit this part out, right?
I want sure. to look for yeah, a poem. Yeah.
It ends with coming down to the water, and I never know what these poems are called. Yeah, here it is, yeah. Okay, there's a poem called Solstice Coming.
Yes.
I'll read this. This is the one, actually, it's the one you were talking about.
Yeah, I've got my bookmark in it, actually.
Yeah, I'll read it to you.
Yeah.
It's typing with my left forefinger today. The poem is immensely slow. One letter, one word, one line at a time. This, and then this, and... Amazing how the images slow to an intimate crawl, each word a salamander peering from beneath a stone. The fish this winter are wraiths, the pond's perfect thoughts. I have tried to love this quiet as the hours pass through me. It is rare to feel anything deeply. My life is a feast if I allow it to be. The slow rain falls without cease. It eats the ice, one drop at a time. These days, my body breaks down, and I cannot lift my right arm. My poems now are thin as I was when I lived in the mountains. I tried to believe the lake when I came down from the high snows. I watched the water for a long time from the safety of the trees. It was a trout rising, made me see what a day is. A ripple only.
Yeah.
Now, the last image of that, the mm-hmm. last three lines about coming down to the lake from the high snows, I've been north of Babine Lake in northern BC, and I backpacked in from the lake. I got a ride across the lake by a guy, and he dropped me off on just on the other side of the lake, and I headed off into the backcountry for a while, and stayed there for a long time, quite a few days, and I just needed to get away from the world and get away from people and get back into the wilderness, because I've always loved the wilderness and spent much time there when I was young. And I remember when I came back out again, I stopped before I got to the beach, and because I knew that if I went down there, eventually I would be able to flag a boat and go back to civilization, and I wasn't sure I wanted to. I mean, I knew I would, of course. I knew I wasn't going to stay out there because I would have died if I'd stayed out there, even if it was summer. But I remember thinking about that a lot, Joe, before I did that. And, mm-hmm. you know, just staring at the lake from the safety of the trees, you know, and thinking, do I really want to go out there? And after an hour or two of sitting there, I finally said, yeah, I guess I'll go back there. And walked out on the beach and made a little fire and stayed there for a day and a half until finally a boat came by and he gave me a ride across the lake. And I went back to, I think, where was I? In Smithers, I guess. And spent some time in Smithers. And then from there I went to New York City. I don't know, just wandering back in the day. But
yeah.
Those things, those old memories come back to you and you try to find some descriptive device that'll catch hold of that. It's all right to tell people that your life sometimes is just a nanosecond. It just goes by so quickly, it's gone forever, right?
Yeah.
We don't pay much attention to it, but if I can say, you know, staring at a trout rising, you know, and sometimes when the trout rise on still water, you know, you just see that little ripple, a little nose of the nose of the trout's just touching the surface of the water, maybe picking off an insect, and you see that little ripple, and then it's gone. And you say, yeah, that's a whole life right there. So you try to find that kind of an image. I mean, I've always believed in not telling people how to feel or how to think, but offer them an image or a picture of something and having them respond to it.
Did you find that we as readers spend a lot of time, say, reading between the lines, trying to figure out what you're trying to say?
Yeah, I guess so. I do a lot of writing retreats. You know, private writing retreats. I've tried to give back to my community what my community gave to me. I mean, people back in the day, way, way back in the years, you know, when Al Purdy and Milton Acorn helped me with their, not so much personally, but their poems helped me tremendously back in the early 1960s when I was the young writer in the North, far away from the cities, and then later on getting to know those men and women too, that just to be with them and talk to them, you know, they helped me a lot. And now that I'm older, I've tried to give back the same way. There's a lot of people out there who need help learning how to write, and they can't get into the universities because universities are designed for young people. They don't want old people at universities. They take up room for one. They want to take one course, and the university wants you to take a slate of courses.
Mm-hmm.
If you take one class, then that means somebody can't fit. So they really discourage older people from going to university. So I do a lot of teaching of people between the ages of probably maybe 35 and 90.
Mm-hmm.
I try to help them, you know. I mean, I can save them 10 years I learned things slowly by myself. And it took me 10 years to figure them out, and I can save them some time. I can't teach them how to feel things, and I can't teach them, I can't give them talent, I can't give them, you know, any kind of vision, I can't give them those things, but I can sure and hell teach them some technical stuff and show them how a poem is put together. And so I try to do that.
Yeah,
that's one of the ways I have. Maybe that's the same as pulling ivy off trees.
and
you give back.
Yeah, and so what's the editing process like? Are Lorna's the first pair of eyes that see your work?
Well, actually, I've just been writing an essay for a book that's coming out in the spring. I don't know if the book has even got a title yet, but it deals with the wars, you know, the McCrae's poem and the poppy, mm-hmm. and the rest of it. And Romeo Dallaire is writing a piece, and various people are writing pieces. And so I just finished a piece, and I swear my wife saved the piece. I was ready to toss it. I was so frustrated with this essay I was writing, and I gave it to her, and she gave me some really remarkable editing, and it really helped me tremendously. So, yeah, I get edited. My poem's not so much.
Mm-hmm.
I figure my poems, you know, but even there, occasionally I'll show a poem to Lorna, and she'll give me a, you know, she'll touch me up a little bit and say, well, that's not working there, is it? And, you know, but it's delicate living with a writer, you know, because Lorna will show me a poem, and she said, take a look at this. And I said, well, do you want me to read it for pleasure, or do you want me to read it as a critic? And there's always a moment of hesitation. She says,
right.
Well, you know, be nice.
Yeah.
Because us writers get, you know, as Al Purdy says, I am a sensitive man, you know.
Yeah.
Writers are sensitive people.
Mm.
You want her to say, oh, this is the most wonderful thing you ever wrote. And instead she says, God, that's, you know, you got to fix that paragraph. So, yeah. I've been edited by the best, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my novel, Red Dog, was edited by Ellen Seligman at McClellan Stewart. And she is one of the top four or five editors in the English-speaking world. She has that kind of reputation.
Yeah.
I mean, she's seriously respected, you know, all over the world as a great, great editor of English literature. And she took on my novel, and I'll tell you, that was the journey of... I learned how to write a novel by editing a book with Ellen Seligman. She was great. Great editors are hard to find. Harder to find these days when publishers don't want to spend the time.
Yeah.
They can't afford to hire a whole bunch of editors to deal with those things. So a lot of books get shoved through pretty fast. And you can tell, looking at them, that they needed the help of a good editor, and they don't get it. So.
So last month you were invested in the Order of Canada, and you've gotten a number of awards and accolades over your lifetime, but there have been a few in the last couple of years. For you, it must be nice, but in some way, does it validate the writing?
Well, you know, I mean, you're an artist, right? I'm a writer. Other people make pots and paint pictures and, you know, and make video, and every, you know, the creative is the really the great reward. At the same time, you know, it's like the cult of celebrity and the competition for prizes. You know, I find it very destructive for writers, very destructive for artists generally, that they have to compete. You know, they want the public to respond. So what they do is they name seven writers to a list, and they say one of these books will win the big prize, and all seven people show up, and one person gets it. And the moment that that person's name's announced, all the TV cameras turn away from the other six and focus on the one person, and the other six all go home. And they're never talked about. And it's very deflating and very hurtful and very, very hard for artists to deal with the kind of world that the publishing world or the art world can make your life very, very difficult and hard. And a lot of artists, for most artists, they continue to work at their craft, regardless of what it is, in spite of those kinds of almost like insults. So getting an honor like this, it's a great honor. It's happened late in my life, and I'm now an officer of the Order of Canada, and my wife's an officer of the Order of Canada. She got it a couple of years ago, and you think about it before you accept it. I had to think a bit and thought, do I want to accept this or do I want to reject this? And I said, no, I want to take this. I felt that, not because it was my due, but because I think the country does its best to honor its best. And to me, it was an acknowledgement of a life lived, I think. You know, you write and you work for 50 years, and I'm lucky enough to have received a lot of praise for what I've done, you know. But that doesn't change the fact that I'm just the guy who sits in a room, you know, with a pen or, you know, a keyboard and tapping away with his left finger, you know, and that's where the real work gets done. The other stuff is just, you know, they give you these big things just before you die, you know. They don't give them to you when you're 20.
No. Yeah. But the reading Washita gave me a lot of moments of where I sat up and went, oh. And so to be able to talk to you about it and to listen to you read from it was such a thrill today. And to talk to you again, it's a great pleasure.
You know, Joe, you do good work out there. You know, the work you do is good work. You know, you too are an artist, you know. You have your own, everybody has their gifts, and you're a very good interviewer, you know, beyond just me. I've listened to what you do, so. No, it's a pleasure being on the show, you know, to be asked. I'm really proud of this book. It's among the really mature work of my life. I didn't expect to write another book. I had my collected poems out a couple of years ago, and I thought, well, maybe that's it. And then this book happened, and it pleased me greatly to have this book out. And my publisher, old Howie White, you know, he's been my editor and my publisher for, God, my little book of poems, Unborn Things, was the first book of poetry, or the second book of poetry, maybe the first book of poetry he ever published.
Really?
And now look at him, eh? Howard White, Harbor Publishing, third biggest publisher in Canada.
Indeed, yeah.
You know, so he stood by me over years when I was not as thoughtful and respectful as I could have been to him. So I'm grateful to him, too. Gotta be grateful, man.
Yeah, indeed. Well, give my best to Lorna, and happy Christmas to both of you.
Yeah, you take care, eh?
You too. Thanks, Patrick. Yeah. The website for more is patricklane.ca. The book is called Washita. It's from Harbor Publishing. It's author Patrick Lane. Join me on the line from Saanich, British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.